6 o'clock. Call the work session of the Newport City Planning Commission to order. First item on the agenda is the attendance roster. What do you call that? Yeah.
Roll call.
Yeah, roll call. There it is. That's just looking away. Commissioner Brannigan has not yet joined us by a video. I'm Bob Berman. Commissioner Hanselman?
Yes, I am here.
Commissioner East?
I am here.
Commissioner Escobar?
Here.
Commissioner Updike?
Here.
Commissioner Blum?
Here.
And Advisory Committee Member Capri?
Here.
And Advisory Committee Member Sutton? Okay. First item on the agenda, update of the on status of the Quinnebay Estuary Plan update.
Thank you, Derek Tokos, Community Development. For those who've been on the commission a little bit longer, you may recall back in 2021, this process started up. This is a the technical information that supports policy for how and where development can occur within the Quinnebay Estuary is driven by the Estuary Management Plan. That plan is 40 years old and was sorely in need of update. A lot of the natural resource inventories were way out of date in terms of where sensitive shellfish beds were, eelgrass beds were, things of that nature. And there have been a lot of changes in terms of land uses that occur within the bay. Log rafts, for example, aren't that common anymore. So the state, through the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and partnered with the cities and the county to initiate this planning process. It's being led by the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And it's been a long go of it. They have a Willamette Partnership is who they are. They hired as a consultant to do this work. There's a policy advisory committee of elected officials and other key stakeholders. Councillor Parker serves on that for the city. And then there's a steering committee of the technical experts, and I sit on that particular committee. They are finally to the point where they're going to begin to vet some of the revisions to the plan. This was a schedule that I included in your packet to kind of show where they're at. The revisions, a lot of them are designed to try to streamline the provisions in there, make it a little bit clearer in terms of how they're to be applied. But there will be some substantive changes relative to climate change and the expectation that with development projects within the estuary that there'd be some consideration about climate change. Exactly how that's framed could have a significant impact on the port because they're the principal party in our area that's doing development within the development areas of the estuary. Let me think. The other thing that's coming up, and I didn't include it in here, is that you may recall back in 2016, there was a lawsuit that ultimately the decision was that FEMA, who does our floodplain management, was in violation of the Endangered Species Act. And from that, there was a resulting biological opinion, and it has languished for many years with FEMA. But lo and behold, they decided to fire that process back up and are working now on what their interim measures will be to comply with the Endangered Species Act. We're not sure exactly how that's all gonna play out. They've got a virtual open house scheduled for the 18th and 20th of April. They have a comment period on that piece that closes on May 5th. It could result in a significant curtailment of dredging activities within the bay, which would be a big hit for the port, especially with the existing NOAA moorage, OSU's moorage. Those all have to be dredged regularly along with the commercial fishing moorages. And it could have an impact on development that adjoins the bay in terms of habitat analysis to show that you're not having an adverse impact on listed salmonids. So the two processes are now coming together in an odd way, and I think one of the challenges moving forward will be for DLCD to try to explain the difference between what's being done on the estuary management plan and FEMA's process to comply with that lawsuit.
Swing your microphone over.
Yeah. The bottom line on this is that we have, DLCD has committed to doing a series of meetings with planning commissions and city councils on the final draft of the management plan update. And so once we have a sense of when they're prepared to do that, we can get that worked in on your work schedule. You'll have a chance to take a look at it and see what its recommendations are. Once that plan is finished, then we would need to initiate a round of updates, first to the relevant section of our comprehensive plan that addresses the estuary, and then to the section of our zoning code, which sets out the what we call estuary management units, which is what we use to evaluate development when it's proposed within the estuary. So that's kind of how the process will go. So it looks like they'll be wrapping up probably around the end of July or early August, so early part of next fiscal year or latter part of this calendar year, we can expect that we'll have to kind of start working on those two pieces. So I hadn't checked in with you guys for a while on this. Finally to a point where I have something to report. So that's why I added it on the work session.
Excuse me, Vice Chair Berman, I just want to acknowledge that Chair Brannigan has joined the meeting through Zoom.
Thank you.
Hey!
Derek?
Yeah.
I noticed one of the meetings was maybe a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
Are there more of those meetings? Are they open to the public? Are they publicized?
Yes. I did include in your packet a link to the project website where if you want to stay updated, there's
that's the place to go.
That's where you want to go.
Okay.
You can sign in there to get on their email distribution list. And yes, it's to my understanding their meetings are open to the public.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Did any commissioners attend the open house at the library? I was ill and couldn't make it.
Did not.
No? Just curious.
Yeah.
Question I have. So I noticed a couple of slides about matrix versus zoning districts. So I assume that was part of the presentation. What was the takeaway of that? Did they try to gather advisory committee comment on that? I mean, I'm a fan of the matrix. I kind of like that, but where are they headed?
They seem to be headed away from the matrix.
Oh. Of course.
I don't know, kind of somewhat semantics. The matrix is a component of our zoning regulations. It's whether or not you structure the zoning regulations with a matrix to identify what is permitted, frankly, subject to review or some sort of public hearings process, conditional review, or not permitted at all within the estuary. There's nothing that's generally permitted outright. If you're doing any development in the estuary, it's generally subject at least to a staff level review. So, yeah, they're kind of stepping away from the matrix. There were some concerns that the matrix was too confusing for some folks. So,
okay.
Any other questions, staff? Okay, moving right along to discussion of the results of the housing production online survey and recommended housing production strategies.
I know that's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yep.
So I'm going to adjust this over here. There we go. Okay, so this is a PowerPoint presentation. I'm just going to walk through this with you guys. Okay, for the record, I'll be very brief. You guys already know this, but again, the city has been, since for some time now working to update our housing plans. It came in two pieces. There was the socioeconomic data and analytics piece, which was the housing capacity analysis, which was already adopted. And then there's the strategies piece, which is the housing production strategy, which will identify how, you know, what steps the city is prepared to take in addition to what it's already doing to try to help facilitate the construction of needed housing. So we're on part two, the housing production strategy. So we met with the advisory committee for last time on March 30th. Most of the meeting, the members were able to be there, but not everybody. And so we have a meeting with the balance of the committee scheduled for the 17th. And, you know, we had had, by then on the 30th, we had the results from the online survey that we had run from, it was like March 1st to the 20th or something like that. It's in the material. We had over 450 responses, which was pretty good. And so I'll be kind of touching on each of those. In terms of next steps, well, maybe I'll wait and surprise you with that when I get to that slide. So we are getting close to kind of wrapping up the process. We're over here. Towards the end of the month, on the 25th of April, we will do an in-person open house here at City Hall. We'll be getting postcards out on that and press releases and other outreach to let people know about that. And it's really to let folks know how their feedback from the online open house has been incorporated into the plan, because there were a few adjustments based on that. And then also in recognition that there will be some folks that are basically learning about it for the first time. And so it's an opportunity for them to kind of learn about what's been going on. When that wraps up, then we will have commission, you guys will have an opportunity to provide a recommendation, probably set this for your first meeting in May, because by 15th of May, we want to get this in front of the City Council in resolution form for potential adoption. So, you know, it's been an iterative process with the advisory committee of identifying potential actions, narrowing those actions down, vetting them with the public, adjusting those actions based on that feedback to land into the final draft. This just kind of ran through kind of how we did that with the advisory committee. There were quite a few different groups and stakeholders we engage through the process. This slide just kind of summarizes who all we engage through that. So a number of community conversations. We had a number of developer interviews, service provider interviews, project advisory committee, and you all know that there were a number of folks. Braulio served for the Planning Commission, but they were all key stakeholders when it comes to the provision of housing within the community, and they served diligently through the course of this project for 9 meetings. So yeah, we ran the open house from the 1st through the 20th, 454 responses. All right. So this was just a slide that spoke to, you know, what's your current housing situation? Most folks live in single family detached. Now this doesn't break down how many of those folks are renting versus owning, just the type of housing unit that they happen to live in. So nothing earth-shattering based on kind of the mix of housing product we have out there, multifamily, manufactured. The other thing to keep in mind is my sense is manufactured actually a little bit higher, 9%. There are a number of folks that don't realize they're living in a manufactured house. You know, so.
But does that overwhelming preponderance of single-family detached potentially imply that the outreach maybe wasn't done to the most optimized manner to reach a broad selection of the community? Or is that just, I mean, I'm sure that's not the ratio of total housing, or is it?
No, you had a little bit larger percentage of folks in single-family detached that responded. I mean, we did a carrier route distribution on the postcards, so it did get to folks who live in apartments.
I got one. I live in a condo.
Yeah, so we reached folks, but we can't compel folks to participate. And so it may just be that, this is just how it played out.
Bob, the next slide does, though, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, when you look at the next slide, I think it implies that. Is that the homeownership one? Yeah. That one made me think, okay, you're getting a certain group that's responding right there when 67% own their house.
Does Newport have a concept of how many single family houses we have? I mean, we should. It should be on the tax rolls or accessible from the tax rolls, how many single family houses we have within the taxing district.
Yeah, it seems like.
And Derek, that would give us an idea if the 60% is.
We do.
I'm not asking for that number now, but it would give us an idea of whether this 60% is something that is.
It's close to 4,000 in that ballpark on the single family. You have another 1,000 of multifamily, and then you've got everything else kind of bundles in there for another, 700-800 or something like that.
That 67% ownership, though, that says something about who responded.
Yeah, yes, it does.
It does. Yes, it does. I mean, this is a good representative sample, though. I think you have to keep in mind, too, that often folks that are renting are cost burden. They're working multiple jobs. They have less time to do something like this survey. They've got other things that they've got to deal with. So I think there are a lot of other dynamics in play that have nothing to do with the extent of the city's notice and just life. But we have a good response. When I look at that, that's still quite a few renters who've responded, and that's going to influence, what came of that is.
Was there a mailing sent to every Newport resident? Because I think I got one about the online open house and opportunity to provide input.
It went to postal carrier routes, so anybody who's getting mail got one.
So there was a wide effort to embrace everybody in the community.
Right, and that's in addition to other, press releases, things of that nature. But the postcard was our biggest effort.
Right. Okay.
And that was over 8,000 went out. And part of that too is that was more than the city because carrier routes extend beyond the city boundaries. But you need to do that just to make sure you catch everybody.
Then your assessment was the 400 plus responses you got was greater than you typically get on something like this.
That was a good response.
Good response, all right. Mm-hmm.
And the consultant's perspective was that was a very good response. We also worked with our rec center, and we worked with through the library to try to get that out to folks, too. So we tried some other things. And, we had the school district on board, so they had the information as well. So, it's a pretty good response.
It was a straightforward way to do it, too. I don't know if that's, proprietary to Eco Northwest, but actually, taking the survey was easy. For how many questions they had, criteria.
Could you talk into the microphone?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Oh, I was just saying that the criteria when you were actually going through was quite easy to use. There's a lot of questions, a lot that you had to fill out, and it worked well.
Thank you.
Dustin, how many months, years ago did you say doors?
Doors, more doors.
Doors. Need more doors. Doors. That's
more
what you said.
Doors. Come on, more doors.
It's been his mantra.
We still do.
And his problem has gotten more acute as time marches on.
So, percent of respondents very concerned about different housing issues. This is very helpful. Housing availability, major issue. Cost of rent, major issue. Cost of home ownership. Property taxes, also big issues. Condition of available housing. Quality of available housing, certainly rated up there. Cost of utilities. But as this tapers down, a little bit less concerns relative to the variety of housing type sizes. Accessibility still a meaningful percentage, for those with disabilities. Discrimination in housing. Too much growth too quickly. Nope, not a major factor at 20%.
The discrimination one is interesting.
That can be both.
I mean, I always think of the city as, not having that problem, unlike some metropolitan areas. Do we have records of actual discrimination, or is this just a gut feel?
I think that's the experience that folks have had, either through trying to obtain rental housing or trying to purchase a home.
Yeah.
Now, there may be some comments in the attachments that folks chose to provide that could shed some light on that, and we can dig into that at a later date. I just wanted to kind of go through the high level today.
Sure. Derek, what's the difference between condition and quality?
Well, that's a good question, but I think condition, you could have a quality place how do I say this?
I had trouble with it.
Condition, I would say, of available housing means it's in poor maintenance condition. Quality is it has what you want and okay. meets your needs well. I mean, you can have a good condition studio apartment, but it's too small.
Yeah.
So the quality of that housing's not very good. I thought this was a really good one too. Concerns about development of different housing types, running from single family detached across multifamily and mixed use. Again, affordability carried the day across all categories. Particularly acute for single family detached, but still pretty meaningful even when you get down to the multifamily.
Derek, were the responses broken down by folks who were renters versus those who were homeowners?
I don't believe so in here. I think it's based on whether or not it's just your concerns relative to each of these. So that would be everybody. Parking not enough. Came in second. Parking and the more that's required has implications with respect to affordability. So you always have that interplay there. Existing neighborhood compatibility. Building design, not so much a concern. These concerns dropped off pretty considerably. Too many homes in an area, too few, too much parking. Certainly didn't carry a whole lot of that, but it did have a few people who do feel, I mean, and we talked about this with the committee, it's like, who would say that there's too much parking available? Certainly, a few people did. And if you look in certain areas of the city, there are some areas like the over by the high school, in those areas where you have very wide streets, Eads, some of those others, that you have a ton of on-street parking that's not utilized a whole lot because there's also a lot of off-street parking, so. So there's some areas where there's an ample amount of parking and would warrant comments like that, certainly. But it wasn't a major factor, as you can see. This slide got at housing types that we generally don't have much of. So it's some of the, trying to gauge general public support for some things that we could try to help facilitate within the community. Transitional housing, single room occupancies.
What does transitional housing mean in this context?
That'd be like,
go ahead.
Transitioning from incarceration. They have there's a couple of structures that the probation office has to help people transition from prison to regular life.
It could be homeless too. Homeless transitional housing for the homeless.
I think many folks were looking at it as what Marjorie was talking about in terms of camp. Type arrangement where you'd have the Conestoga huts, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're in a program for 6 months and they provide housing for you. You
trying go to transition a program you into more permanent housing.
Yeah, to try to get you into more, rental or homeowners even. Housing, maybe.
Tiny houses in micro-villages, tiny houses on lots, modular prefabricated housing. So it's not manufactured in the traditional sense. It's not the HUD manufactured housing we're talking about there. We're talking about more modern modular projects, products that are, coming out in a number of different states where, they basically take the house up in a kit and it gets installed on the property. And so your costs are substantially lower since you're really dealing with just getting site utilities in and your foundation issues. And then they put the house together relatively quickly. It was interesting, we had some discussion about this, that some of the areas such as RV parks scored so much lower than others, and what might be the cause? Well, part of that might be the fact that we have some RV parks in this community that are pretty old, and some of them aren't well-maintained, and that may weigh on folks when they're providing responses. Whereas when they're talking about tiny home villages, we don't have any of those, but they're thinking about examples perhaps that are online, and they say, oh, that's really cool, it could be. So, moral of that being, if get the standards right, so when it gets developed, people say, hey, that's a, you know, that's a complementary type of housing within the community. So there were a number of different potential strategies identified in the housing production strategy document. We distilled these into lay terms. They're in much more detail in the actual housing production strategy, but we needed to make sure when they did the online survey, we put that in terms folks would appreciate and understand. You don't want to jump out with system development charges and people's eyes glaze over and they go, I have no idea what that is. I'm not sure I even want to respond to that. So try to reframe it in terms folks would appreciate. For the strategies, number one, lobby the Oregon legislature for more resources and flexibility to support housing development. Not a surprise. A lot of the issues that we face are issues that are beyond our control. Infrastructure is a major impediment. There's not a lot of money for it. The only way that's going to happen is coming from the legislature. We provided some examples in here, you know, like a real estate transfer tax, which those funds would be dedicated, for example, to land banking, buying property for affordable housing. That'll take a change to the state constitution, and that would have to be a referral from the legislature, but that's something you can lobby for. Room tax. For years, we've tried to get a little bit more flexibility with how room tax could be used. Can't use it for housing right now. Again, legislature, not the city. And so dealing with seasonal housing, and we're not talking about short-term rentals here. We're talking about seasonal housing that's just sitting there most of the year vacant. Well, you can adjust your tax structure as a state to make that less attractive. Again, legislature, not the city. Going after local improvement districts to allow those costs to be financed over a longer period of time on your tax bill, as opposed to if you and your neighbors want to have a street paved, having to come up with all of that at the end of the project. I mean, so there are things that can be done at the reciprocity, you know, where right now, you know, we can't hire plans, examiners, and inspectors from other states because their licenses don't transfer into Oregon. Because, you know, so, you know, it's pretty hard to, even if the legislature gives us additional funds to get more inspectors, they just don't exist. And to get them in from out of state, they end up having to go through a battery of in-state exams that could take upwards of a year before they can actually be doing anything. So, I mean, these are all things we can't do locally, but they can do at the state level. And so that's, I think, in part kind of why something like this was going to come up pretty high. Support partners in building affordable housing for home ownership. Work with landlords and tenants to ensure that rental housing is well maintained. That led to an adjustment on the schedule to kind of bump that up, to have a conversation with the council about what it would take to do that. That requires staffing resources at the local level. You know, that's our building official can't just take that on as other duties is assigned. We would have to have specific staff to be going through rental housing units. They need to be people with his expertise to be able to identify, you know, deficiencies in rental housing that need to be corrected, that kind of thing. But what we can do is identify what it would take to operate a program effectively, and then the council can decide whether or not, you know, they want to try to resource it.
If a tenant has a problem with, say, their electrical, who do they complain to now?
Usually their landlord to get it fixed.
And then if the landlord doesn't?
Withhold rent.
Just a legal?
Fair housing, maybe? I don't know.
There may be some state, Bob, I'm not totally up to speed with what a renter could do at the state level to see if there's a way for some recourse. And there's been a lot of activity the last two legislative sessions, so there may be some new rules coming down in that regard.
Property condition, you know, is as a category falls into this an awful lot.
We do occasionally.
I know there's code violations, that's one thing. But just, you know, the hot water heater doesn't work and he won't fix it.
Yeah, that's just not going to come to us. We occasionally will get a complaint about roof failure, you know, where you got, you know, a serious compromise in a roof or something like that, or wiring, but it typically doesn't come from renters. So, support regional housing partners with housing development for low and middle income households. Get a low barrier emergency shelter and warming center going in Newport. Those would be the real, you know, above 50%, the highest priorities that folks had identified. And while it's not, all of these carried some degree of support, so even when you get down to the lower end here where you're talking about outreach and education to promote equitable housing access, that gets a little bit amorphous and hard to get your arms around. That could be one reason why that score's a little bit lower. Another, you know, the advisory committee discussed is really, one, there are a lot of other entities out there doing that. In many respects, the city's a support partner, not the lead partner. So it's assisting the others out there so they get their message out a little bit better. And recognition that any time we do outreach and education of any form, that's a pretty significant dedication of staff time. So we need to make sure we have a handle on that. reducing zoning code barriers kind of fell into that under 40% too. While it's not a huge percentage, there are some things we can do locally. And we'll want to talk about that in terms of what we can do locally to help move the dial there. There may be some adjustments we want to do on how we deal with building height, for example, for multifamily. Excuse me.
Number 9 fascinated me. I thought that was a state-dictated procedure.
It is. It had been on the since the early 80s. But I would be, to be candid, on the flip side, we don't have a lot of residential. We have almost zero residential land that's undeveloped, that's in our UGB, but outside the city, that would be of residential, that we could expect some meaningful number of units. Where we do have residential, it tends to be like surfland, which is already fully developed with little half acre to 1 acre properties. So it's unlikely we would see much in something like that.
But up off the end of 32nd, 31st. You know, we got that one development going in, that was brought in from the UGB, that land swap.
Yeah, the land swap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there more land behind that could be serviced?
Not readily. I mean, your terrain gets even worse as you go back that direction. You know, you're getting into steeper timberland, and it's a little bit harder because you're having to extend those utilities even further out. This is a summary that Eco Northwest put together based on their read off of the survey and the comments that. And we have there's general agreement that the actions identified in the housing production strategy are appropriate, or those that we're already implementing had support. And we spent some time talking about those that we've already implemented. They still require attention too, and so we gotta keep that in mind. When we offer a program, for example, like the multiple unit property tax exemption, you know, that's something we have to continue to monitor and for those in the program, and we may want to expand or adjust it. So something to keep in mind. High level of interest in addressing houselessness and increasing housing stability. A lot of support, obviously, for the getting an emergency shelter going. School district representatives highlighted the need to include, you know, support families with children. They can't necessarily they can't stay at the same place as some others in a low barrier emergency shelter, given that the issues that some of those folks are going through. would be a conflict for folks with small children. So how do we accommodate both needs?
Derek, I will say that in SF, we actually started a program in the school where we converted gymnasium to a housing opportunity for houseless students and families. Highly controversial, really difficult to manage, but at the end of the day, once they worked out some of the bugs, actually worked out pretty well.
Who managed it?
Championed by the school district.
Was it?
With assistance from, I mean, obviously San Francisco has a lot of resources, so there's a human services agency that had staff to assist. So you have wraparound services, but you actually did it on site in the school. So it was an intriguing concept.
Was it the school district that managed it, or nonprofit stepped
essentially in to do co-managed. It was a school district property, but with nonprofit assistance and full-time security. Yeah.
Well, it's a great example. It's certainly two districts, some of the larger urban ones often have surplus property that you know, because they've had a loss in student population,
right,
they can repurpose some of those buildings. For a period of time, it appeared that we may have one at some point at Aquinaview, but enrollment changed, and so they had to ramp back up again. And so that's when Aquinaview became more actively used. So part of that is what, you know, each jurisdiction has different opportunities based on what their circumstances are.
Right.
Wasn't Karen Gray on the committee?
Yes, she was.
Was that brought up at all, anything like that, or no?
I'm sorry?
Was anything like that discussed?
No, I'd be pressed though right now to see what school property would be available. It's all heavily utilized right now.
Was it only used in the evening? Or was it like a surplus gym?
No, it wasn't surplus. This is an active school site that was converted in the evenings to address having a place for those students.
I see.
To go
so
to.
That so it was made available again for gym use.
Right.
The next morning.
So the next morning, back to regular school operations.
Yeah,
it
interesting.
It was a challenge, no question, but it actually worked. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It was just, I just mentioned it because I noticed, you know, some pretty startling statistics in this about how many houseless students there are in the system here, which surprised me.
No, thank you for that.
Is the county equally concerned as we are about this problem? Are they going through similar exercises or something different to actually work towards some solutions?
Yes. I mean, the short answer is they are also very concerned now. Their role is different. Much of what they have that they would have under their land use jurisdiction is rural, with limited services and limited capacity for additional housing. However, they also provide all of the social safety net and social services that go hand in hand with providing the appropriate level of services for those that are houseless. So mental health services, you know, helping folks, you know, get back on their feet, get jobs, get food, you know, all the basic things you need. They're a major player there. And so they're going through, and you know, it's discussed in here too. You've got a 5-year plan to get a kind of a strategic plan in place, multi-jurisdictional effort. We're part of that too, but the county is taking the lead on that. It's one of 8 pilots statewide. House Bill 4123 is what its genesis was. It was $1 million to each of these 8 pilot areas for the purpose of trying to help rural areas develop more capacity to provide services to those that are houseless, so that they are in a position then to tap into state funding and actually help build up smaller nonprofits in this area to partner with. And so that 5-year strategic plan, that work on that's ongoing. That's their primary focus right now. But yes, they are actively engaged.
I can think of one property that would be perfect, but.
So some additional discussions with stakeholders about actions in the, okay. You know, supportive services require more resources. You know, Hatfield Marine Science Center, we did spend some time talking to them. As you know, I think when we, back in 2014, we did some changes to our housing policies in anticipation of a scaling up of student enrollment at Hatfield, trying to make sure that that didn't all come on the shoulders of the community, that OSU actually provided some housing for that purpose. And so they've struggled mightily. They've gone through three different iterations of what they could do. They did buy property. It's in Wilder. It's a 5-acre piece. You've approved three different options, none of which they've been able to implement. They are moving now forward with a fourth option. It'll be 75 units of multifamily. And the difference here is Hatfield's going to be the one overseeing this, not OSU student housing. That had been a major challenge for them. OSU student housing had a hard time kind of getting its arms around what happens in Hatfield, which is kind of more of a housing need here is not just students, but it's also for staff. And, you know, and so that's not a dynamic OSU student housing normally deals with. Hatfield is a different critter with respect to it being a multi-agency collaborative. OSU manages it. They have a significant footprint there, but you have a whole, you know, battery of different state and federal agencies that also operate in that location. And so, and they all have staffing needs too. And some of those students aren't strictly work, you know, at OSU, but they also have collaborations with those other agencies. And so it was determined, you know, that I think they're moving forward this time. Hatfield's gonna take the lead. You'll probably see a final development plan amendment, fourth iteration here in the coming months. So it's moving forward. They did say that their enrollment path is not as rapid as they had hoped. It's a much slower, gradual increase. And so their expectation is that this particular move should be sufficient to accommodate their needs for the foreseeable future.
Do they see that slowing of growth having anything to do with the housing issues that students would face coming over here?
They didn't mention that okay. that regard. It had more to do with how their programs are structured.
Sure.
But, you know, everything's an evolution with a state university, so.
Yeah.
But they are saying phase one should be finished by fall of 2024, so that'll give you a sense about when they'll, I mean, they need to be, they are going to be moving forward here relatively soon. Definitely concerns about vacation homes, impact on availability of long-term rental units. Vacation homes come in two flavors, as we know, short-term rentals being one, which we do regulate. Seasonal housing, one that we don't, you know, so. Do. So, you know, we spent some time with the advisory committee just making sure we went through kind of the, make sure they were comfortable with what we had, went back over the existing strategies, which I'm not going to spend a great deal of time with you on because you've already gone, you guys are familiar with these. Summary actions, I'm going to skip a little bit past here. This is a part we spent a little bit of time on, which was the implementation timeline. The way this is going to work, when it's adopted by resolution by the council, is that if we're going to have to do regular reporting with the state, because the state's going to be trying to stay on top of where all of the different jurisdictions in the state are and trying to move the dial on housing. And if we get it done earlier, great. If we miss one of these timelines and we're behind schedule, then the state takes a more active role. Why are you missing resources? What's the issue? It becomes a little bit more involved. So tried to be realistic as we set these up, made some adjustments based on the feedback we received through the open house. One of the things to talk to the committee about is you may see a lot of these kind of lining up in the same time frame, and you go, how you pull all these things off at the same time? Well, we bundle them. And you're probably, some of you may be familiar with how we did that in 2017. We brought a package to you of a number of different changes, from system development charges to affordable housing excise tax to the tax credits. We brought the whole package together. There's a beauty to that in that it does give you a sense of seeing how the pieces fit together and complement one another. And there's a lot of efficiency there because we're moving it at once, one round of public outreach to cover multiple topics, all of that. So I think it's doable in terms of how it's outlined.
Is there any talk about some kind of temporary homeless solution rather than waiting 2 years?
We certainly don't want to wait 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years. The temporary solution to date really has been partnering with nonprofits, and this is warming shelter only, with nonprofits to provide them the funding they need to secure hotel rooms for folks when it's very, very cold. If we can move it faster, we'll move it faster. But these things take time, identifying a site that's suitable, vetting it with the community, getting the funding needed to, because no site's going to be ready. You know, it may maybe, you know, so you're going to have to do site improvements. So there are a number of pieces that fall into that that's going to require to take some time. Monitoring and implementation, these pieces, this is what we have to report to the state. It's an ever-increasing list of stuff. You know, from their perspective, though, the more information, the better they are in terms of their understanding of how things are working on the ground throughout the state. Then we spend a little bit of time talking about, you know, with different strategies, we have a different role. And so this little table just kind of showed that. Okay, one thing I mentioned, we had hoped to do the open house on April 12th. It's actually going to be April 25th, still at 6 p.m. here at City Hall. And again, the purpose of that one is to kind of walk through the reasons for the study, you know, what we found, key findings, that kind of thing. Share with folks how their feedback through the online survey was incorporated in the final results, and then to inform folks who haven't really been engaged in this at this point and just trying to learn and understand what's going on. Answer questions.
Will that be a formal presentation or just
That's our plan. It's going to do a formal, given the subject matter, we thought that a formal presentation would work well. We are going to actually, it reminds me when I send the ad out this request that folks bring their phones with them. So there'll be some instant polling that'll be part of this. And so that they don't have to just sit through a canned presentation the whole time. There'll be some interactive components to it that we'll build into it. And we hope to have some of the advisory committee members there too. So it's not just staff and the consultants responding to questions, but some of the advisory committee members as well.
That meeting will be here?
Yeah, here at City Hall.
Okay.
So that's all I had on that particular topic.
Thank you, Derek. Next item is pending housing bills in the Oregon legislature. We have about 10 minutes to cover some of the developing stories.
So I included in your packet just really that's one of the comments that our council chose to make on House Bill 3414. I'm going to actually stop share because I don't know that there's a whole lot of value in sharing that tiny font stuff. This legislative session has been heavily oriented towards housing and homelessness statewide. a number of bills have either gone through or are still alive and being worked that address those issues. When it comes to housing, you'll see that the general tenor of a lot of the focus of the legislation has been on processes largely at the city level that are viewed as an impediment to getting housing on the ground, and public involvement at the local level, which is similarly viewed as an impediment to getting housing on the ground. And so what you see is a series of bills that are designed to take policymaking bodies such as yourself out of it, to take the public or curtail public opportunity to appeal to LUBA, limit LUBA's scope of review. And 3414 also includes a whole battery of things that we would have to, at a city administrative level, grant variances to development standards. If a developer wants the variance, and right now, even doesn't necessarily even move the dial in housing. So, I mean, they're really just kind of scrambling with that. You know,
Bob, did you see the draft of Spencer Nobles and Mayor Sawyer's letter to the governor? It was towards the last part, and I think it addresses some of those SAES issues where they're the state's trying to change the process.
Right. So that particular bill is still alive. It was moved out of committee on the last day. It could be moved out of its original committee. It's hanging out in House rules, and it's a governor bill, so it's probably going to get adopted in some form. And we're working with along with other jurisdictions, we're working with the League of Oregon Cities to improve it to the best that we can. I'm trying to get it focused on, you know, instead of identifying you have to grant variances to everything except this narrow list of things, which then leaves you thinking, well, what are all the unintended consequences? To something more like, here's a list of things that you have to consider for variances, because in doing so, it's likely to move the dial in housing. The principal issue here is not Newport. It's not rural communities. This is a metro fight, in a fight about, you know, larger developments coming in greenfield sites in and around the Portland metro area and some of the larger cities. We get caught up as collateral damage as part of it. And so we'll see how it goes. But you know, expect that coming out of this legislative session, we're, you know, like we always do, we're going to have to make some changes to our code. Expect that to be kind of the general direction it's going to be going.
In the conversations with lobbyists, have we attempted to see if they could just carve out rural communities?
That has been raised.
And how did that go?
The league struggles with that because there are smaller communities that are closer in within metropolitan planning organizations that don't like these either, and they're having a hard time saying, well, how do we carve out for this group but not this group, and they're similarly situated. So it's a tough conversation for our lobbyist, which is the League of Oregon Cities, which represents all cities. Mm-hmm. So, but yes, that conversation is being had and will continue to be had because some of the things they're considering have a disproportionate impact on rural communities. And if we're not the real target of this, then why pull us into it?
Right.
You know, so.
Thank you, Derek. Any highlights you want to point out on the revised work program?
You know, just one thing that I neglected to include, we do have a conditional use permit for a photo photography studio down on the bayfront. It's one you actually had previously approved. He's moving to a new location, though, and these conditional use permits are specific to the property, not the individual. So we'll have a public hearing on that.
That's the one with all the costumes and stuff.
Correct, yeah. And that'll be April 24th. But outside of that, I don't know that there's... I'll be doing a new one for coming months here shortly because I'm kind of getting towards the tail end of this particular one. So maybe at the next meeting I'll have one that kind of forecasts out a little bit further.
Thank you. Okay, why don't we take a 5-minute break here and then we'll get into the regular session.